On March 29th, the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, issued a report, Climate Change 2014 Impacts Adaptation and Vulnerability. This, basically the message of this report is the whole damn planet is burning. All right. And we can't just sit here and watch. All right. There's really got to, people really got to think about what's going on. The rise in global temperatures due to fossil fuel burning and other human activities has already hit the planet's food supply, water resources, and oceans. And poor people are suffering the most all over the world. But nobody's going to be untouched by all this. And I had the opportunity to talk to Dr. Michael Mann, a distinguished professor of meteorology at Penn State University and director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center, yesterday. And we're going to run that interview starting now. The final draft report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is associated with the United Nations, their final draft report dated October 28, 2013, of the Working Group 2 Contribution to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Fifth Assessment Report, Climate Change 2014, Impacts, Adaptation, and Vulnerability, was accepted by the IPCC on March 29, 2014. And it consists of the full scientific and technical assessment undertaken by Working Group 2. And part of this that was just intense is the part that dealt with what is going on, what's the impact of global warming, of climate change in the world now. And it's really, it's a very chilling thing for anybody who has any concern about the future of humanity, the future of the planet. You need to read this, but you also need to be aware of the fact that this is something for great, great, great concern. Joining us to talk about this now is Dr. Michael Mann. Dr. Mann is a distinguished professor of meteorology at Penn State University. He's also the director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. And his research involves the use of theoretical models and observational data to better understand Earth's climate system. Dr. Mann was a lead author on the Observed Climate Variability and Change chapter of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Third Scientific Assessment Report in 2001, and was organizing committee chair for the National Academy of Sciences Frontiers of Science in 2003. Dr. Mann is the author of more than 160 peer-reviewed and edited publications and has published two books, including Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick in the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. It's good to be with you.
The last report from the IPCC came out 7 years ago. Now there's a new one. What's changed since then? Where are things at now?
Well, it's really striking when you read this latest impacts report. And so there are three different parts of the IPCC report: the basic scientific evidence that came out just this last fall, this latest report is on the impacts of climate change, adaptation, vulnerability, and then next month they will be reporting on the final installment, and that's on mitigation solutions, what we can do to mitigate the problem of climate change. So this latest impacts report was striking in really just how stark nature of the terms in which it is laid out. You know, this is a very conservative report by its nature, because this is a consensus of literally hundreds of leading scientists around the world, and so the report reflects almost a lowest common denominator of what all of the scientists can agree upon. In that sense, it's remarkable that the report states the threat in as stark terms as it does. Basically, what this latest report makes clear, if there were any question, is that climate change is not just some abstract, far-off existential threat. It's not just something that is going to impact polar bears in the Arctic decades from now. It's something that is impacting us here and now negatively. And in a sense, we are the polar bear. We are seeing the negative impacts of climate change, whether you are talking about issues of food and fresh water availability, whether you're talking about land, availability of land, whether you're talking about human health, whether you're talking about the health of our economy, whether you're talking about issues of conflict and national security, which, after all, are a consequence of competition for available resources. And what the report makes very clear is that if we continue on the road that we're on right now with ongoing fossil fuel burning, we will see diminished food, water, and land, and greater competition for diminishing resources among a growing global population. And that's a perfect prescription for issues of conflict, for basically a national security calamity. So the IPCC makes quite clear in this latest report that climate change is a big problem. It's not just that we know that we're warming the planet, that it's caused by human activity, fossil fuel burning and other activities raising greenhouse gas concentrations. There is now an established consensus among the world's scientists that this is a threat to us now, here and now.
Yeah, that actually came across very, very clear. And I think it's something that, one, is consistently, over the years, it's been consistently sort of like, well, yeah, you know, they're warning us now, but really, what's the rush? And we can actually do something about this. I wanted to ask you about this because it's been bugging the hell out of me, all right? The idea that when we're talking about climate change, they're talking about the temperature rising, for instance, the temperature change from 2 to 8 degrees Celsius is the span. Is that happening now? Is that what's happening? And what does it mean if it does?
Yeah, so we've already warmed up. We've warmed the planet just under 1 degree Celsius, about 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit so far. It turns out we are already committed to at least another 0.5 degree Celsius, almost another degree Fahrenheit. And that's just because of the greenhouse gases we've already emitted into the atmosphere. They will continue to warm the planet for decades. Even if we were to stop fossil fuel burning cold turkey right now, we would still see the planet warm for decades into the future, just because of the inertia of the climate system. As the oceans continue to absorb some of the heat that we have already put into the atmosphere from increased greenhouse gases. So we're already committed probably to, you know, the better part of 2 degrees Celsius, 1.5 degrees Celsius at a minimum. And what the science tells us is that if we continue business as usual, fossil fuel burning, for another decade or so, we will almost certainly commit to more than 2 degrees Celsius warming, more than 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit warming. And that's an important number because that's actually the threshold that many organizations and scientists who look at the impacts of climate change will tell you that 2 degrees Celsius threshold is where we really start to see some of the most damaging and potentially irreversible impacts of climate change. Again, whether we're talking about food, water, land, health, across the board, the health of ecosystems, every aspect of our lives, we will see increasingly negative impacts. And so there's an urgency to this problem, unlike anything we've seen before. If we don't act now, we likely commit to at least 2 degrees Celsius. If we continue with business as usual, if we just continue to burn fossil fuels without any effort to regulate carbon emissions, to lower our carbon footprints, then what the report tells us is that we could see, you know, as much as 4, 5 degrees Celsius, you know, 7, 8, 9 degrees Fahrenheit warming of the globe by the end of the century. And as James Hansen, my colleague James Hansen, the former director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, once put it, if we warm the planet that much, it'll be a different planet. It won't be the planet that we grew up on. We will be leaving, you know, a fundamentally degraded planet behind for our children and grandchildren.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Meteorology at Penn State University, and he's also the director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. Michael, one of the things that you keep pointing to is the fact that this is actually on the map now. It's actually concretely happening now in terms of climate change. And I wanted to talk about that and in relation to that, both what's happening in relation to food, for instance, in the vast majority of the world, which is a constant question. You know, you could see that the famines that exist in all parts of Africa and other places. If you've ever traveled at all through the third world, you have some understanding of, you know, how desperate people are for the barest minimum diet, you know. And you guys have been saying that okay, well, this is going to have a terrible impact on crop yield, on food. Let's explain that.
Yeah, and so that's one of the tragedies here, that in fact the worst impacts and the impacts that are going to come soonest are going to be felt in the developing world, precisely those areas in the tropics where you have nations who are currently struggling to meet their needs when it comes to fresh water and food. That's actually where climate change initially is going to hit hardest. And some of that is based on really fundamental science. If you warm temperatures even a little bit in the tropics, we know that you see very large decreases, very substantial decreases in the productivity of basic cereal crops. And that's simply because those crops are already growing sort of at the limit of temperature, the warmest temperatures they can grow at. And if you warm even a little bit, you see sharp drop-offs in agricultural yields. And so, ironically and tragically, those nations that are least able right now to meet their food needs, we will see the largest decreases. Now, we used to think, and as recent as the last IPCC report. If you read the chapter on agriculture in the impacts part of the last IPCC report, there was language that suggested that we could actually see increases in agricultural yields in some extratropical regions, like, you know, the United States, North America, Europe, other areas at higher latitudes, the idea being that, you know, you get longer growing seasons in a warmer planet. You know, winter is shorter, the growing season is longer, and all other, you know, all else being equal, that would seem to imply increased agricultural yields. But something we've seen over the past few summers in particular is that any theoretical increase in yields that might result from longer growing seasons appears to be getting completely wiped out by increasingly extreme weather events, more widespread and pronounced drought over large parts of the U.S., like we've seen in recent summers in Texas and Oklahoma. In summer 2011, Texas, their agriculture was devastated. They lost 25% of their livestock because of the record 2011 drought. Two summers ago, we saw record drought and heat over a large part of our breadbasket, and agricultural yields were decimated. And so we now think that even extratropical regions where we thought maybe we could see an increase in agricultural yields, even here we will see decreases. And that's why this latest report comes to a much starker conclusion when it comes to food, our ability to meet our food needs. And, you know, again, what we're talking about is a growing global population in the face of diminishing food and fresh water. And that's, you know, a calamity in the making.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Meteorology at Penn State University, and he's also the director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. Now, there's a point here, Michael, that gets repeated in the report, and I think it's important for people to understand what's meant by this, and it keeps talking about adaptation and adapting
right
in relation to this. Can you explain what's going on there, and then I have a follow-up question after that.
Sure thing. So our presidential science advisor, John Holdren, who's a leading scientist and has been a very effective spokesperson for this issue in the current administration, I think he once framed the problem best when he said that how we deal with climate change is going to be a combination of three things. It'll be some combination of adaptation, of mitigation, and of suffering. And it's up to us to decide what is an acceptable combination. Now, we are already seeing the suffering. There's a certain amount of climate change that's already locked in. It's already happened, and there's more that's in the pipeline. And what that means is that there's already some suffering, and there'll be more suffering in the future. It means that we already have to begin adapting, whether we're talking about building up our coastal defenses against sea level rise and increasingly devastating hurricanes, whether we're talking about adapting agricultural practices in the face of warming temperatures, worse drought. On down the list, there are a whole bunch of things that we need to start doing to build the adaptive capacity to deal with some of what's already in the pipeline and is coming. But the fact is that if you look at sort of those business as usual projections, if we continue on the course that we're on, by the end of the century, we are talking about changes in climate that are so unprecedented that there's no amount of adaptation that will basically, you know, maintain any degree of resilience in the face of the impacts on food and water and health and our economy. So the bottom line is, if you look at the projected impacts, this latest report, one comes to the conclusion that adaptation is not going to be adequate. We need to do a certain amount of adaptation no matter what, because there's a certain amount of climate change that's already locked in. But the fact is there's a whole lot of other climate change that we can still prevent, and we need to engage in those actions necessary to prevent that. And that means reducing our carbon emissions. And that means putting, you know, a price on the emission of carbon so that the marketplace will internalize the very real damages that climate change is already doing across the board.
I was going to ask you about, is there a point, is there a tipping point where adapting is just clearly impossible, and I think you spoke to that. You know, one of the things that struck me is there seems to be a dynamic that gets set in motion as well, which would both severely limit effective responses, like in terms of being, you know, saying that an effective response will be adapting, but also adds a whole new dimension. And I was reading somewhere about the melting Arctic that uncovers organic material that was there, you know, frozen over like before civilization began, that suddenly is laid bare and begins to rot and releases all kinds of greenhouse gases and just compounds things a tremendous amount. That seems to be something that people don't often talk about what gets unleashed in a sense of a dynamic that actually gets unleashed to take over.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's, you know, we sometimes call these positive feedbacks, although that can be a misleading term to sort of a lay audience that isn't familiar with the sort of the lexicon of the science. It almost sounds good, positive feedback. You know, you get positive feedback from your boss for doing a good job. It's not a good thing. What it means, it's a vicious cycle. It means it's an aggravating response. And one of the feedbacks that we worry about are, you know, these so-called carbon cycle feedbacks. And what that means in this case is if, you know, as you allude to, if you warm the soils, if you melt the permafrost in the Arctic, well, it turns out that there's a whole lot of methane that's currently locked up in that permafrost. There's also a lot of methane that is locked up in a sort of a crystalline form, a solid form in the continental shelves. And as we warm the planet, as we warm the upper oceans, and as we warm the permafrost, there's the potential to destabilize all of that methane that's currently locked up. Now, methane, it turns out, is an even more potent greenhouse gas than CO2. So if that kicks in, if we start to see those methane feedbacks kick in, then it means that suddenly we get even more warming. And that's not currently really taken into account because it's too uncertain. We don't know how to include it in the models. Because we don't know exactly how much of that methane is potentially unstable and could be released with even a modest amount of additional warming. So it's a great example of, you know, how uncertainty, despite, you know, what you might hear from the critics, you know, you hear people say, well, there's uncertainty in the science, so why should we take these precautions that could damage the economy? Well, actually, inaction is likely to damage the economy a whole lot more. But the fact is that uncertainty doesn't weigh in our favor. In many respects, the uncertainties are such that the problem could end up being a whole lot worse than we currently project. And here's one good example of that, Arctic sea ice. Right now, we are seeing a precipitous decline in the amount of ice that's left in the Arctic at the end of the summer, to the point where if we follow the current trend, within a couple decades, we will have ice-free conditions in the Arctic by the end of the summer. The models say that we shouldn't be there for, you know, for decades, for 50 years or so. So we are already several decades ahead of schedule in terms of how fast that sea ice is diminishing. And with that decreased sea ice means a fundamental change in the Arctic ecosystems. It means a threat to the animals that rely on that environment, which of course includes the polar bear and walruses. What it means is that we are losing an entire ecosystem. We are losing a unique ecosystem, the Arctic ecosystem, that will not be replaced. And, you know, what's the value of the Arctic ecosystem? What's the value of the Gulf of Mexico? These are the questions we should be asking as we continue to engage in very dangerous drilling of fossil fuel sources and the continued worsening of the climate change problem that's resulting from that.
All right, Dr. Michael Mann, this is unfortunately we've run out of time, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Sure, you too. All right, so we'll talk to you again sometime soon as this develops, all right? So stay in touch.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks.
All right, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Dr. Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Meteorology at Penn State University, and he's also the director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center.